On this week's 51%, we take a look back at some interviews and stories we aired during 2018, ones that both serve as a reflection and perhaps indication of what lies ahead. In politics, music, the military, opinion, unapologetically.
All the rules are out the window.
I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. As record numbers of women ran for office in 2018, and there were a number of firsts, Jennifer Palmieri believes that this might not have happened had Hillary Clinton become president. Palmieri served as head of communications for Hillary Clinton's 2016 presidential campaign and White House communications director under President Barack Obama. She was also White House deputy press secretary for President Bill Clinton and national press secretary for the Democratic Party. She's president of the Center for American Progress Action Fund and author of Dear Madam President. I asked whether she thought Hillary Clinton's loss was a gender issue or likability factor.
I think the likability is about gender. And that's what I have come to conclude. I don't conclude that she lost because she's a woman. She did receive 3 million more votes than Trump. She proved it's possible for women to win. There was a lot of factors that led to the loss. But I do believe that this notion of likability, there's something about her I just don't like, there's something about her I just don't trust. I think that is related to her gender. I don't believe that everybody who didn't vote for her or didn't like her is sexist, just that I think we have a hard time still seeing women in positions of power and having the ambition to want to be in a position of power. And I think that Hillary had always, for about 40 years, since the time she was in college, had been stepping outside of the role that women normally played. From when she first gave her commencement address at Wellesley, that was controversial and landed her on the cover of Life magazine, to when she was Bill Clinton's wife, who didn't stay home and bake cookies and didn't change her name, and the first lady who had an office in the West Wing and worked on policy and ran for the Senate. She's always vexing us. There's confounding us, that we don't have a way to think about her. There's something about her we just don't like. And I do think that's rooted in us not knowing what to make of a woman that has that kind of ambition.
And at the risk of oversimplification, you know, however one might perceive her, be it bossy or opinionated, one would not use those same adjectives for a male, I would presume. It would be, oh, he's in control or he's in charge.
Yeah, I think that's right, Allison. And there were moments in the campaign that brought all of that home for me, right? And there was one very telling moment, which was the concession speech. And a lot of people loved the concession speech. And these are friends of hers, right? These people who love her. And they said to me afterward, you know, well, where was this side of her during the campaign? Why couldn't we see this side of her when it mattered? And I think they're referring to is that she was very gracious and selfless. And we like that in women. We like that in all people, but we particularly like that in women. And when you're running for office, you don't get to be that way. You have to say, I want the most powerful job in the world, and I think I'm the best person for the most powerful job in the world, and here's all the reasons why I'm better than the guy I'm running against. So that is hard for us still to hear from a woman. And I think, you know, people thought Hillary could do the job. That's progress.
So they like the conciliatory tone, which you can't have during the campaign. And what do you take away from this whole thing?
I didn't think of myself as having to make my way in a man's world. I thought I was doing great in it. And now I see I managed to do great fitting into a man's world, but there were still ways that it limited me. And I live my life very differently now.
That's really interesting, Jennifer. Would you talk more about how you're doing things differently?
You know, I had experienced a lot of support in my career. I'd had a successful career, but you know, there's still ways that you're held back. I was the communications director. I wasn't the strategist, right? There are still jobs in politics that women don't quite get. I certainly had experienced all the ways where, you know, like a lot of women do, that you're in a meeting, you offer an idea, nobody reacts to it. 3 minutes later, a man offers the same idea and everybody thinks it's great. And I had just managed to thrive in that environment. And I thought that if I played by the rules, I would be rewarded. And that's what I felt that we did in the campaign. We proved that Hillary could do the job just the same way that it had always been done. Trump was a very unconventional and nasty candidate, and we played by a conventional set of rules, and I thought we would be rewarded and that America would not select him. And then it did. And I thought, wow, all the rules are out the window. And I saw that, you know, the last step that women had to take was to not wait for permission, but just go out and get what it is that you want. We had that power all along. But I think, you know, for my own life, I didn't see it. So I decided to write a book. I decided I learned a lot. I've never done this before. I had something to share. I have something of value, even though we lost. And I'm going to write a book. And I do consulting. I don't have a normal job, and I don't want one. I'm sure I could fit right back into the man's world, but it doesn't really suit me. I am bored by it. I want to be part of an environment where I can bring my whole self to work, which includes emotion and passion. And sometimes I cry. And, you know, these are things that have been, you're told as a woman you were not allowed to do in the old world. And I don't live that way anymore. You know, in the book, I wrote a chapter called Nod Less and Cry More. And it's about this concept of the way that women, I think, women adapt our behavior to fit into the workplace, what we're told is professional. I know what professional means. Professional means the way men behave. And I talk about crying at work because I'm very emotional. I am also very strong, but I easily move to tears when I'm talking about something that is important to me. And I don't think that we should have to mute all of that. We shouldn't mute what motivates us, what inspires us, what makes us feel passionate about the work that we do. And I was saying this to a reporter, a woman, during my book tour, and she said, well, but what do you say to people who say it's just not professional to cry at work? I say it is. I'm not going to sit here and spend 7 minutes defending why I think that that is professional. I'm just telling you that I think it is. And that's enough. And I realized in that moment that I had, and I think a lot of women do this, you know, I've had two conversations going on in my head, what I believe in my heart, and then you check that against what you're told, what society has told you is expected of women and what we're supposed to think and how we're supposed to behave. And only after I check myself, then do I speak. And I think that's why women sometimes stammer before they speak or hem and haw, or why women change their minds, because the first time you opened your mouth, you had to censor what you really thought. And I'm not doing that anymore. I don't know that anybody ever told me I needed to behave a certain way. There's just all these clues that we pick up, ways that we feel like we're imposters. And I think for, you know, women in the workplace, women candidates, we're having to make our own way now. I think we've proved, yeah, I can do the job just as well as a man. You know, I think people accept that by and large. Men and women can do the same jobs, but I don't want to do the job the same way he does. I want to do it different. And you know, women aren't waiting till they have the perfect resume to run for office. They're just doing it because they have enough sense of themselves that they're good enough as they are. And that's revolutionary. And as devastated as I was by Hillary's loss, I am very inspired about all the opportunity I see women making for themselves now.
That was Jennifer Palmieri, whose book is Dear Madam President, a compendium of experiences and lessons from her days in the Obama White House and Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign, to name a few. It's a letter to the first woman president and all women seeking positions of power. Aretha Franklin, the Queen of Soul, died August 16th at age 76 from pancreatic cancer. She was remembered as a gospel and pop giant and a civil rights beacon. Justin Patch is a postdoctoral fellow in music at Vassar College in Poughkeepsie, New York. A musician himself, Patch specializes in the intersection of music and American politics, and he spoke with 51%'s Ian Pickus the week Franklin died.
Upon her death, you wrote that she's an artist who changed the way fans listen to music. What do you mean by that?
Well, it's one of these things that we learn about the possibilities of expression by hearing or by reading or by seeing what other people do. And I think that the way that Aretha Franklin took you know, gospel and religious music and put it into popular music. She was not the first person to do that. You know, Sam Cooke and Etta James and all these other artists before, but she's somebody that brought that sound into people's living rooms, into people's cars in a way that people really hadn't, you know, no one else really had had that sort of reach before her. And I think that was very special, to the point where when she released a gospel album, people who weren't necessarily religious went out and bought it because they were so fascinated by the sound of her voice. And I think that she took the potential for that sort of musicianship and really put it onto the airwaves in a way that was very, very special.
You specialize in, you know, music and the intersection with American politics, and a lot of people this week have been remarking on the fact that she did live to perform at the inauguration of the first African-American president. After the 60s and through just, you know, this week, where do you think her legacy sits now in terms of, you know, the way the country moved politically in the last half century?
Oof. That's I think I would have had a very different answer for you 3 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But I think her legacy when it comes to advocating for civil rights and for human liberation on the whole is something that I think we're still unpacking. I mean, I read an article, you know, 2 days ago about her saying she was ready to put up bail for Angela Davis when Angela Davis was being held in New York, and the way that she explained her advocacy for Professor Davis was that, hey, this is a strong black woman who is for the liberation of black people and for human freedom, and I have to get behind that. And so that legacy of really caring about respect, I mean, her sort of signature song, and the way that she advocated for human dignity and for women's rights and for civil rights throughout her career is something that I think we will look back on in 10 or 15 years and say that she was one of these incredible sort of shining beacons for 60 years of her life, and that her legacy, regardless of what went on around her, whether it was, you know, the riots in Watts and Newark and Detroit, or whether it was, you know, white supremacists in Charlottesville, that will look at her and listen to her music and say, this is what it means to be dedicated to the cause of liberation. And that's not going to change.
A lot of people, of course, have been remarking on the unique quality of her singing voice. But as a musician yourself, what can you tell us about her playing? Because she was known to, you know, accompany herself on several very important recordings.
Well, I was just listening to her recording of Sam Cooke's You Send Me this morning. And if you want to hear a very concise demonstration of her musicianship as a keyboard player, that's about as good an example as I can possibly give you. I mean, the uniqueness of her phrasing, the way that she uses the full range of dynamics. She goes from loud to soft. She uses these incredible passing chords, and the way that she uses her voice, and which is what everybody knows, what everyone listens for. If you go back to those Atlantic recordings when she's playing piano for herself, you hear the way that she uses both instruments together, her voice and the piano, and the way the piano supports her voice and plays these really great sort of offbeat accents and really bolsters a very unusual signature way of phrasing that only Aretha Franklin can actually ever sort of sing a musical line like that. And it's as equally important that she supports her own singing by accompanying herself. And that's, it sounds like the most natural thing in the world to be able to, you know, play and sing at the same time. But there are very few people that really are able to step out and make a song their own on two instruments at the same time. And Aretha Franklin was one of those people who was able to do that.
Lastly, do you see an heir to Aretha Franklin in you know, current music?
Well, I don't, and that's partially because I don't think anyone should ever try to sing like Aretha Franklin. I think the thing that made Aretha Franklin great was that she was so unapologetically herself all the time. And that's what made her presentation so incredible and so memorable, is that she wasn't trying to sound like anybody else. And I think if we get one takeaway from her, is that, like, take who you are unapologetically and make it musical. And that's exactly what she did.
That was Justin Patch, a postdoctoral fellow in music at Vassar College in Poughkeepsie, New York, speaking with 51%'s Ian Pickus. The Pentagon says about 15,000 service members have experienced some kind of sexual trauma while in uniform, but because of the stigma, many wait decades before they seek help. Bobby O'Brien visited a special unit at a VA hospital in Florida. There, survivors of military sexual trauma receive intense inpatient treatment.
Living with a sexual trauma is tough enough, but when it happens in the military, there's an increased level of power and control, according to VA psychologist Jessica Keith.
Often the perpetrators are someone in the command line, someone who has more power, and power not only to ruin someone's career, we also have to remember these are people with weapons who are trained to use them, so it can be terrifying when you're sexually traumatized in the military.
Keith manages the Bay Pines VA Center for Sexual Trauma. Their residential co-ed program treats veterans who have severe PTSD because they were sexually assaulted or harassed, which can be especially traumatic if the perpetrator is a fellow service member.
If they're in your unit, you're told that these are your brothers and sisters. This is your family, that they're supposed to have your back. So what does it mean when somebody who's supposed to have your back is the same person who sexually assaults you? It really increases the severity of the trauma on that person.
So restoring trust is part of the treatment. Survivor Jackie Thorington, an Army veteran, says she felt betrayed and ashamed when her military superior assaulted her decades ago. Thorington entered the Bay Pines residential program in January because her outpatient therapy sessions weren't helping.
I needed specialized care, and I knew that things were really going wrong. I was very depressed. I was suicidal. I couldn't function at work anymore. I really thought that my world was done, that I was going to kill myself.
At Bay Pines, she meets with a therapist twice a week for prolonged exposure therapy, where she tells the story of her assault over and over until the strong fear associated with the memory decreases. 7 days a week, she's in a group session with the other 15 women and men in the program, and they often go on field trips to be exposed to real-life situations like a crowded mall. After just a few weeks, Thorington felt a difference.
My life's given back to me again. I'm 53 years old. I don't have another 53 to go, you know, maybe, but what I do have left, I want to enjoy it and not be looking over my shoulder anymore.
The program is designed to reintegrate veterans back into their communities, their work, and their personal relationships. It treats about 100 veterans a year in the residential program and another 400 as outpatients. Dr. Alfonso Corina is chief of mental health at Bay Pines. He says he's seen veterans become more open about sexual trauma during his 17 years there.
So now we have more males that are really coming forward and being assessed for military sexual trauma, which in the past, it was a no-no in the military to kind of share those experiences.
He says the program has changed as well during that time. It's more open to trying different treatments when evidence-based care doesn't work. Keith says it's all about letting veterans set their own goals.
We ask them, what do they want to see different in their life? For some veteran, it might be straightforward. They want fewer nightmares. They want less PTSD symptoms. But others want something very different. They say,
I want a date.
Yeah, I want to be in a relationship, finally. Whatever it is for them, that's what we work on.
Bay Pines was the VA's first residential program to treat both men and women and remains one of only a handful. But every VA medical center now has a military sexual trauma coordinator. I'm Bobby O'Brien in St. Petersburg.
And we revisit a recent essay from writer Dr. Jerry Burns.
As arts educators who go in and out of different schools, my storytelling partner Barry and I experience a variety of school traditions. For example, many schools invite clapping at the end of assemblies. But Ballantyne Elementary School in Fuquay, Varina, North Carolina, does it differently. At Ballantyne, the firefly is the school mascot. So instead of clapping, the students open and close their fists, like firefly lights winking on and off. In that way, they express their appreciation with a firefly glow. Traditions vary in other ways, too. In some schools, administrators greet us when we come into the building and tend to us throughout the day. In others, a representative of the PTO or the media specialist does this. And in still other schools, the only official or representative we ever meet is the secretary who takes our ID, gives us our visitor's pass, and points us in the direction of the classroom or cafetorium. Of course, there are some things that are universal at schools, like telling younger children to sit crisscross applesauce. And, in every public school where we work, the morning announcements include the Pledge of Allegiance. The pledge always sends me reeling back in time to when I was a little elementary school kid. I didn't truly understand why I had to say the pledge, and I definitely didn't understand all the words. I mean, how many six-year-old children know what a republic is? Not only that, I had a lot of creative pronunciations for the word indivisible. I said it differently nearly every day, and often I didn't mispronounce it, but instead created a malapropism by inserting a word I knew. So instead of saying indivisible, I said invisible. Now, I knew that the pledge had something to do with honoring my country and soldiers, but I didn't relate to it or understand it on a personal kid level. So now, as an adult visiting artist at schools, when I hear morning announcements, that feeling of childhood confusion echoes. One morning recently, I was in the Chalmont School District in Schenectady. I was putting my harp together when morning announcements started. Eventually, I heard the pledge. All those feelings came back. But I was jostled out of my reverie because the rhythm of the pledge's ending was different. There was an addendum. My ears stood at attention as I listened to a child's voice utter another pledge. As members of this school, we promise to care about each other. We will help each other whenever we can. We promise to make our school a place of joy, discovery, and respect. Above all, we will always try to never hurt anyone on the inside or on the outside. I turned to Barry, my storytelling partner. Did you hear that? What was that? There was something authentic and achingly touching about it. A few minutes later, the principal came into the room. I rushed over to him and asked. He smiled so big, his eyes twinkled with pride. You like our school pledge? Like it? I loved it. That pledge was written by our students, he said. They wrote about it 10 years ago, and boy, has it stuck. These are their words. Well, I did a bit of tweaking, but not much. This is what is important to them at school. No wonder it stuck. I asked him if he would share the text with me so that I could share it with you all here on 51%. He was delighted. As I held the paper with the pledge in my hands, I wondered what I would have written when I was a kid. What thoughts would I offer to a school-wide pledge? I would have loved having a student-composed pledge about things I really understood with words and meanings that made sense to me. I'm not saying we should drop the Pledge of Allegiance. It has important things to teach. But having a child-composed pledge to say would have made a profound difference for me every time I put my hand on my little heart. It seems to matter greatly for the kids and principal at the Jefferson School. Maybe the Jefferson School pledge could help us all remember how important it is to care for one another, to respect one another, and above all, as they say every single school day morning, to always try to never hurt anyone on the inside or on the outside. Maybe if we could each hold on to the meaning of their language, the children's wise words can help make our grown-up lives a little more indivisible.
That's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett and Elizabeth Hill for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% Archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1536.